My name is Elaine Breek. Today is March 3rd, 2001. I'm with Dr. Joseph Dobner, who was commander of the 475th MASH unit during the Gulf War, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I want to ask you just a few questions about yourself here. Do you have a middle name?
Jacob.
Jacob. And you live here in Frankfort?
Yes, ma'am.
And your birth date and year?
Is 3 January.
1948. Okay. Place of birth?
Chicago.
And you're a doctor? Your mother's name?
Vivian Dobner.
And your father?
Joseph.
Oh, you're named
after
him.
I'm not a junior, though. He did not have a middle name.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we've got that done. We're still working fine. Okay. Tell me a little bit about yourself. I'll start off where you went to school.
I went to, high school, back in Chicago. I went to Holy Cross High School. And then went on to Wake Forest University to undergraduate. And then I did medical school at Wake Forest also. And then went into the military then, and did my internship and specialty training at Fitzsimmons Army Medical Center in Denver, Colorado. After that, I did a two-year tour at Fort Knox, and that's where I got introduced to Kentucky. It was nowhere near, nowhere on my wish list. They give you seven choices of where you want to be stationed, and it was nowhere, but as luck would have it, they sent me there. I was not particularly happy until I got there, and I fell in love with Kentucky, and I've been here ever since.
Okay. So you joined the military very young in your life.
Yeah, I was in ROTC and undergraduate.
Okay.
So in 1966, I started ROTC.
Okay.
That was during the Vietnam conflict, and it was, many of us were going off to Vietnam, and I thought, well, I'd probably want to go as an officer if I'm going to go, and so I signed up for junior ROTC, which is an optional kind of thing, the first 2 years. And then once you sign up for the second 2 years, then you've got an obligation. And so I signed up, and, 6 months later, they had the lottery. And my lottery number was so high, I never would have gotten picked. But, I was signed up, and so be it. And as it turned out, the military has been absolutely wonderful to me. It has been spectacular.
So did you go to Vietnam?
I did not. No,
No,
they were perfectly happy to let me continue training. Doctors have always been in need in the military, and so they're very happy for you to go to medical school because they know they got you sometime. And so I got to go to medical school and then got trained and then got into the orthopedic program, which is also, that's the 60% of battle injuries are orthopedic, so that is a much sought-after specialist in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So they were happy to have me do all that stuff, and then they had me.
So it was the first time you really went to war, was in the Gulf War?
Was in the Gulf War, right. That was, 1991. I joined the Kentucky Guard in 1980, and just as as an orthopedic surgeon, just as a staff physician. And I guess about 2 years later, I guess it's 2 or 3 years later, it was 83 or 84, I was asked to command the 475th. And it's, the rest is history, I guess.
Okay, so where were you stationed when you were in the Gulf War?
Well, you kind of move around. We first started out, we went to our mobilization station, which was Fort Knox.
Right.
And we were there from just before Thanksgiving till the 4th of January is when we shipped out to go to, we started out in Saudi Arabia. Flew into, I forget the name of the airport now. It's their military airport and on the coast. And then we went to Dharan and lived in some big warehouses for about a week and moved us around a little bit. And then Within a week or so, we drew our equipment and then went up into the desert along. There's this road in Saudi Arabia that parallels the Iraqi border. It's called Tapline Road. And it's right near the town of Hafa al-Batin. And we our brigade was stationed there. And so we set up our different hospital. Well, we didn't set up the hospitals there. You know, where we had our encampments, and we had our equipment with us. And when we first got there, our first order was to go through our equipment, because we drew the vast majority of our equipment out of Europe. You know, all of the equipment was this was all pre-positioned equipment called POMCIS equipment that was ready for the war with the Russians. So if we would have had a war with the Russians, we would have fallen in on our equipment in it's Brunson, Netherlands, is where our equipment was. And that was part of the getting ready cycle, is when we were at Fort Knox, we got a message that we needed to go draw our equipment in the Netherlands. And I was supposed to send a junior officer, and I says, that's not such a good idea. I'm going to go myself. And it was, there was some intrigue involved with it. It went a little earlier maybe than I should have, but I didn't want to get in the end of the line and stuff might not have been there. So I got in the front of the line and apologized for getting there too early, but they were happy to give me all my equipment. And it was spectacular. It was things that, you know, you didn't think the government was going, that would be there. You know, we thought it was a pipe dream. But you walk into these warehouses, I mean, these things are so big, they're as far as you can see. And this equipment is just in premier shape. I mean, just dandy stuff. All the tents were hermetically sealed, and the brand new trucks, you know, our trucks had 50 miles on them. They're all wonderful stuff. It was a toy store. And drew everything out. And the Dutch were running the place. And this first little Dutchman we talked to, you know, was like, he asked, you know, do you want Humvees, which is the newer model of the Jeep, you know, because the Jeep were actually out of the inventory. Most of the stuff we had here were Chevrolet Blazers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a nice civilian vehicle, but it's a military vehicle. They just don't cut it. Now, Humvee is a dandy vehicle. And so he asked me, you know, do you want Cutvees, which is the Blazer, or do you want a Humvee? You know, in his Dutch accent, you want Humvees, or do you want Cutvees? I says, I want Humvees. He says, do you want winches on your Humvees? I said, I want a winch on every piece of equipment I got. And he says, do you want trailers with your Humvees? I says, I want a trailer for every piece of equipment, because you never have enough towing capacity. Especially, I'm going to have a bunch of nurses along, and they like to collect stuff. And so I want as much stuff as you can. And he says, oh, you can't have Humvees have less than 50 miles. You can't pull a trailer unless you have 500 miles on the vehicle. And he says, ah, but this is war. You can have trailers. So it was a fun thing. But we got our equipment, and we met up with it down in the port, and then had to. Then we went out, and we were going to go out into the desert. This is kind of an interesting little side. Like the whole experience was just, you know, exciting. There was excitement every minute. There were decisions to be made, and you know, it was just a lot of things to do, and it made it fun as a commander. I mean, you talk about a blast. I had an absolute blast. Tension, yes. You know, anxiety, yes, but I had a blast. And things, the Lord watches out after me, and everything turned out extremely well, so I was lucky. But when we were supposed to go up to the desert to get ready to fight the war, our advance party, which would be taking our equipment, we had 25 5 tons, and then we had, a bunch of vehicles. We probably had, probably 70 vehicles or so. And we were going to leave at night, and then our main body, that was just with a third of our people, and then our main body was supposed to follow us on buses the next morning. The buses could go faster than we could, so, you know, we thought we'd match up there about right. But that night, all the bus drivers went on strike because they were afraid they were going to get bombed and gassed and stuff. So my back soldiers got stuck in the port, and they couldn't, and the communication was not good, and And so I was really worried about them. And I mean, a week goes by and they promised me, well, we're going to get them up there on the airplane. No, we're going to get them up there on a helicopter. And it just wasn't happening. And I was having a hard time, you know, in touch with them. And is are people feeding them right? And all these things that you worry about as a commander. You know, if you're not there, some things don't get done. So I got my soldiers around me, you know, the night, and I says, guys, we need four buses. And by gum, the next morning we had four buses. They appropriated them, and I don't know where they got them from, but we got them. And so then we went down and picked them up ourselves. We went again, you know, it's a controlled highway. You're supposed to have, you know, convoy clearances and all that kind of stuff. But we just went and got them and brought them up. And you know, I violated all sorts of rules. I thought they were going to, you know, give me all sorts of hard times. But the next brigade meeting, I got an award for, you know, having the ingenuity to get my soldiers up. And then everybody wanted to borrow my buses. All the other commanders, there's 15 other hospital commanders, and they wanted to start borrowing my buses. And I thought, you know, I shouldn't maybe turn loose of these. But then, so I'd have to give them a driver with it, so the bus would find its way home. And they didn't take care of my drivers. And so that's it. You know, I just said, hey, you take the buses, you know, because I'm not going to, you know, risk my drivers for this. So it was another one of those intriguing, fun times.
So you said the bus drivers went on strike. Were they not military?
No. These were all civilian. Civilian drivers, and they were nice buses. They were really decent buses. But when they went on strike, they just kind of left them where they were, and so my soldiers just said, "Wow, there's a bus. We'll get that."
So they drove them.
They drove them. We picked them up.
But what you said, other operating rooms or buildings, were you all close together, different?
Well, no, see, in a principle in the military is dispersion. You always want to be as far apart, you know, even when you're walking down the street, you want to have a big interval so one bullet doesn't kill a whole bunch of people or one bomb kills a bunch.
Right.
So we were out, and when we first set up, we were out in the desert, and there was no buildings, no anything. You could look as far as you could see, and you couldn't see anything or any other person. So there's just 230 of us out in the middle of nowhere. We're probably, you know, 9-10 miles from the next unit.
Really?
But that was good, you know, because there was another interesting thing is that we're told, well, you know, this equipment we had never seen. You know, it was in these big containers and stuff, and it wasn't functionally packed. And so, you know, and doctrine is that once you reach a spot, you should be able to start receiving patients within 8 hours. And if you don't know where all your equipment and stuff is, you know, this is a 60-bed hospital, a high-speed hospital. I mean, that's another thing. The military they never slack on their medical facilities. I mean, we had stuff in this little 60-bed mobile hospital that would rival anything in this country.
So in 8 hours, you have to be up and running.
Up and running. And we weren't packed for that. So, you know, but our commander says, well, don't start setting up your hospital because we don't know when the war is going to start. You know, you might have to get going. And that just didn't make any sense to me. As long as you see tanks, they're ferrying tanks up the road to get into the battle, no war is going to start until they get all their equipment up there. So I said, let's set it up. So we set it up. It took us like 5 days the first time to set it up. And we're the highest speed. But I mean, we set up our hospital back home here, you know, six times a year. We knew what we were doing. We were good at it. But with it not being packed the way we wanted it, we didn't know where stuff was. The second time, it took 2 days, and then we were ready. We knew we were ready. And then we had inventoried everything. I mean, we put our hands on everything so we knew what we had and what we didn't have. And I turned in the things that we needed, and the brigade commander at one of the meetings says, Dobner, what's the matter with your equipment? And I said, you know, I've had it opening up and working twice now, and I know what I got and what I don't have. And all the other commanders go, whoa, 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 you mean those packing lists don't necessarily reflect what we've got? I says, when did they ever reflect what you have? You know, and it was like, oh, my Lord. So it actually changed the whole op plan for everything, because then it was too late to start setting up their hospitals. And I was the only hospital that was really ready to go.
So then you all got all the patients, I guess.
Well, no, we got all the bad duty to do. We had the... you know, anybody who had a difficult mission, you know, that's like the first CAV had the most difficult mission, and every other division got two MASH hospitals, but they said, you don't need but this bunch. They can do anything you need to do. And so it was a proud moment for us, but you know, we knew we were going to be in the thick of things.
Right.
But as luck turned out, there was no fight.
So were you all ever bombed or in the midst of bombing?
No, we could see missiles and planes and stuff going over us when we're out in the desert, because you could see forever. You know, it's totally dark and the stars were almost, you could reach out and touch the stars almost. There were so many of them. It was beautiful, you know, at night and stuff. But cold too. I mean, this is January and we were there'd be ice in the buckets at night.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. This is the desert. It got that cold.
Oh, really?
And then when it rained, holy smoke. The first night we got out there, it rained. Woke up in the morning, and there was 6 inches of water in our tents. It's like, we're in the, what? This is the desert. But it's amazing.
Yeah, I guess it went.
It dries up. Yeah, it dries up.
Yeah.
It dries up pretty quick. And then, you know, later in the spring, you know, after rain or something, there'd be grass everywhere. It's like, how in the, this is the desert. You don't see a blade of anything.
How cold did it get?
Well, it got down to freezing at night.
That's amazing. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, there'd be ice in the buckets sometimes.
So were all your soldiers and your doctors and nurses, they were given the proper clothing?
We had everything you needed. We had these little heaters in our tents, you know, that ran on two-thirds diesel fuel and one-third gasoline. You had, you know, these little jerry cans outside with little potbelly stoves, they call them, and they were dandy. I mean, they'd heat your tent. It was just, they were wonderful.
So it was the conditions for you all were much better than what you see on TV and a lot of the, on MASH. And
well, you know, it's about the same as what MASH was. You know, MASH, they lived in tents and stuff, and they did all right.
Yeah.
You couldn't, there was no flush toilets. I mean, you had, you know, that was a whole other issue, is that you had, you know, and you couldn't dig a trench, so you had these things that, you know, they're made, you know, three holers, we called them, and you went into a 55-gallon drum that was cut off, and then you had to burn it every morning.
What was the hardest part of it, as far as that goes, with the facilities and stuff?
Yeah, getting a shower was tough.
Yeah.
Getting a warm shower was tough. Eventually, we got our laundry stuff up to where we could heat the water pretty good. But taking cold showers is rough.
Yeah.
I remember I took my first shower. I had gone 7 days without a shower. And I finally said, that's it. And I didn't finish till like 10 o'clock at night. And our little shower things the engineers had built, they were little, you know, like three stalls. And they had a 100-gallon tank on top that you hoped the sun would warm the water. Didn't do much. And that first shower I took, I shivered so hard I hurt my neck. It was just, oh.
So that was the very worst of it, as far as not having
it. Taking showers was tough. And just being away from home. Being away from home is just not fun. Just not fun.
How long were you there?
We were there about 4 months.
And then you came back home?
We came back home.
What kind of patients? I mean, who did you treat? Just soldiers?
Or well, people? Yeah. Now that's a whole another thing, is that, you know, during the war, you know, we chased around looking for people to, you know, to treat, and we never set up the hospital during the war. You know, there was only like one or two of the the MASHs. There was only one MASH that set up the hospital. Eventually we had come back to the brigade area back down in Saudi Arabia. And had packed up, you know. You get all these disposables and stuff, you know, sheets, you know, paper gowns and you know, 4x4s and dressings and all this stuff, and medicines and all that kind of stuff. And you can't send that stuff back, you know, after you've beaten it around the desert and stuff. No one would ever use it because of contamination and stuff. So you burnt it, and it was like, you know, it was over $1 million worth of stuff that we, you know, what else are you going to do with it? It costs more to get rid of it, you know.
You just destroyed it when you were finished.
Right. You couldn't give it away. You couldn't do it, you know, so you just burnt it. So we were packed up, ready to go home, and I get a call from the brigade two-star general, and I walk in, and he says, Dobner, how long will it take for you to get back up into the desert? And I go, sir, it took us, you know, 2 weeks the first time, and we're packed up just as is we're ready to go home, and we're packed up just as much as when we came. And he says, you got 2 days, and then you got to go back up into Iraq, because the Iraqi civilians are presenting themselves to our checkpoints all beat up, and they're going to need to...
Do you need to...
Excuse me, hold on. Eric. Okay, all right.
Sorry, Beth. No,
it's okay. No problem. So we were... I said, you got two days to get back up in the desert. And oh, my word. Now, you know, it took time to find stuff, you know, when we were looking for stuff to get ready for the war. You know, you need a widget, you know, and the supply sergeant says, you know, well, there are no widgets. And, you know, I'm sure they're here somewhere. You know, I just had to educate them how to find them. And so they got good at doing all this stuff. So in 2 days, we were ready to go. Now, we did have a little mishap. There were... Now, not all our unit was from home station. We had, maybe a third of our people were augmented to us, you know, from active duty and other stuff like, you know, and elsewhere. And, you know, my deputy commander, Will McKee, commented to me right from the start. He said, Dobner, you know, you're not going to get any first teamers. And sure enough, we had some, you know, my soldiers from Frankfurt were awesome. Never complained. I mean, they just did everything you'd ask of them in a superior fashion. But there were some sad sacks that when I told them that they were going to have to go back up in the desert, they were not happy. You know, they, I even got a couple of death threats and stuff like that, you know, which, they're weenies. They didn't, you know, come on, bring it on. But, and so, you know, the night before we were supposed to leave, someone slashed tires and cut brake lines and stuff, and that really got me angry. But, you know, we were up all night changing tires and stuff, and we left at 8 o'clock that next morning, and we were up there, and we did a great job. We got up there, and we took care of, we actually even published a paper on what we saw. We had a few soldiers who were injured, you know, but mostly civilians, and we had one little Iraqi guy come in with these just raggedy casts on, you know, on two crutches, and he's barely making it, and, you know, find out he needs new casts, and we could put new casts on him, but we took x-rays of his legs, and he had, you know, two non-unions of both shin bones, and, you know, well, what happened to you? And he said, well, he says, I had fallen out of favor with the government, and they drove over me with a big truck and broke my legs. And he's been just kind of hacking around the desert, you know, and I felt so bad for him. And then we had another little Iraqi come in and was complaining of a headache. And he had this kind of big scab on the side of his head, and we took an x-ray of his head, and he had a bullet in his brain. I mean, a decent-sized bullet right in his brain. And he'd been shot like 3 weeks before, 2 weeks before, I think. But there was no... You couldn't find anything really wrong with him other than he had somewhat of a headache.
So could you all treat him then?
Oh, yeah.
With the bullet? And
yeah,
you could
we didn't take the bullet out or anything. There's no need to right at that point.
Right.
If he's not got an infection or anything and neurologically he's intact, you wouldn't do anything. But it was just one of those fascinating things to see.
What about children? Did you ever...
Oh, we had a whole bunch of children. Now, you know, my present wife, who back then was not my wife... She was a pediatric nurse professor at Eastern, and taught pediatric nursing. And so we had probably a third of the people we took care of were children. And we had one little girl die. She had thalassemia, which is a genetic problem, and she came in, you know, bad sick. But that was one of the things, is that the war sapped all of the civilian medical assets out of Iraq, and so the civilians really suffered medically, and so they had to come to us to
be taken care of. Did they just suck you out and come to you all?
Well, what they did is they presented themselves to our checkpoints, you know, where our soldiers were, and our soldiers are going to take care of people. I don't, you know, if you're an enemy or whatever, they're still going to take care of you, and then they'd bring them back to us.
So
and then
you take treated care of the enemy some?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, sure. That doesn't make any difference.
Then what? After you treated them, did?
Then you turned them over to the MPs.
Okay.
And because there were, you know, that was another interesting thing. Saudi Arabia would pay these guys, you know, the Iraqi soldiers, more than they were getting as soldiers in Iraq to be a prisoner. So they would, I mean, They would surrender in a heartbeat. Now, they surrendered to ambulances because they wanted, and then you'd see them on trucks being driven to the rear. And these little guys are they're smiling, giving you the peace sign. They're happy to go to jail because they're going to get paid a lot more than they were. And they were, and their stories were unbelievable. One, you know, some of them were, you know, they said, you know, we've had no resupply. We haven't any. We're drinking the water out of the radiators of our vehicles because there was nothing to drink. Oh,
that's
terrible.
You don't think about that.
Oh, you're right. There's so many things that you learn in these circumstances.
Well, what about being in charge of the MASH unit? Was that anything like Colonel Potter?
Everything about Colonel Potter.
Really?
I mean, oh yeah, you have all the characters and in the intrigue between different soldiers and the romance and all of these things were just so much like it.
That really happens.
All that stuff happens. Everything you saw in MASH, it happens. It all happens.
Well, let's see. What about the people in your unit? I guess they were all ages and.
Right. We had people. Probably the oldest people were in their 50s down to teenagers.
So that was, you had a lot of people, a lot of variety.
230 people. Yeah, and then a lot of different, you know, we had a motor pool, you know, so these are mechanics. Mm-hmm. And then we had, you know, electrical guys who ran all the generators and the electricity distribution. And we had, you know, mess people. We had the world's best mess sergeant. You know, he was just spectacular. We had more hot meals than anybody else in theater. He was just great. I had some, a dental assistant, you know, from the dental unit who came with us. This guy from Frankfurt, Gary Risen, who was the world's best scrounger. I mean, if I needed anything, I just said, Gary, there's a truck, go find us. You know, one time I told him to find, I heard someone that had a shrimp in the theater. I told him, go find us some shrimp. And by God, he came back with a truck of canned, dehydrated shrimp. You know, we had shrimp for days, got sick of shrimp. But he could find anything. He was wonderful.
And one other
interesting story is that, you know, this is the devotion and dedication of our soldiers. Is my first sergeant had just retired about 6 months before we got mobilized. And this guy was a dandy, this Terry Carl. He was an engineer before, but he was the first sergeant of our unit. And he was unbelievably good. And once we got mobilized, I got a call the next day, and he says, hey, Doc, I hear you're going to the desert. I says, oh, Terry, no kidding. He says, do you need any help? I says, would you do that for me? He says, I'll be there tomorrow. And he came, and he resumed his first sergeant slot and was, I mean, the guy's just a star, absolute star.
So the people that went with you from Frankfurt, are they in your unit at...
Every weekend, right?
Okay,
yeah.
And
they came from, like, Terry Carl, he's a supervisor up at Cincinnati Power and Electric. So we drew people from all over the state. We had people from Central City and, you know, different places around. Not everybody from Frankfurt, mm-hmm. but we had a fair amount from Frankfurt.
So you're still in, and you're still enlisted.
I'm still in. Yeah, then there's, now right after Desert Storm, not shortly after, they disbanded all the MASH hospitals in the reserve component. Which I think is an absolute travesty. I mean, it makes no sense. Well, the military in their infinite wisdom, you know, they always look at medical assets a little bit differently. You know, you're a doctor and you ought to be doing doctoring stuff. Well, when you're in the military, you're a commander. I'm responsible for these guys' lives. I'm responsible for their defense and all of these kinds of things. So I need to know the military too. Luckily, I was an ROTC and I understood the military before. But then all my other doctors, I trained them, you know, the military way. They need to be a soldier first and then you're a doctor. In the military, you know, they kind of, if you go to summer camp or something, they want the doctors in a clinic somewhere seeing sick people. I said, no, well, those are times when we need to learn how to be a soldier also. And so now they've got it so that they just have these detachments in every state with doctors and nurses and stuff in there. And if they need to put a unit together, they just grab a bunch of stuff off the shelf, throw them together, say, okay, now you're a combat support hospital. It's like, they've never trained together. You know, and so it's not near as good.
They're not as much of a team.
They are not a team like we were. There's no question. And that, you know, it's something that I'm thinking about now. It's just, you know, these things in Haiti and in Chile and stuff like that. Man, you could have taken our unit, you know, and, you know, with our equipment, it's all in a containerized box. You can put that in a big plane, or even you can sling it under a helicopter. You could put us anywhere, you know, in 36 hours, and we could fix anybody, and we'd be good at it.
But they don't have that.
They don't have that. They don't have that ability now.
Well, what about, you said you just got rid of the supplies when you left?
Right.
Yeah, that's not... What about your vehicles and that sort of thing?
Well, they were much of them were shipped back to the States.
Okay.
But some weren't. Some of the MASH hospitals left their stuff in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabians bought it.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. We had great I'm telling you, we had awesome equipment.
That's just not something I had expected. I don't know why, but I just didn't think that the food was really good too then.
Wasn't bad, wasn't great. The food now, you know, I've been deployed since, you know, just a few years ago I was in Afghanistan. The food has changed dramatically. It used to be all done, you know, militarily. You know, you had your mess sergeant and you had these things called TISs, and I don't know what that stands for, but you'd go draw your food every couple of days and stuff. Now, you know, Halliburton or Kellogg Brown Root does all the food services, and the food now is spectacular. I mean, it's not good. It is spectacular. I mean, you'll get lobster one night and ribeyes the next night and crab legs and roast beef. It's just the best food you've ever had in your life.
What about if you're not a part of like a MASH unit, or if you're out? Do you think
I moved around a lot this last deployment, which was really cool. You know, I used to be the chief, but this time I was an Indian, and it was equally enjoyable.
How was that?
I just got to see a lot of neat stuff. I got to interface with the Afghanis. You know, like this one mission I got. I was a visiting professor to the University of Jalalabad, and the chief of orthopedics. He'd take me home with them and stuff. It was, you know, I got to really talk to him one on one and find out what it's all about to be an Afghani and a Muslim, and it was just so cool.
So, but you actually operated there?
Oh, yeah. But again, you know, the military always has excess medical assets. You know, I'll do more surgery in a week here than I did in 3 months there.
Really? That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. But when the stuff hits the fan, you're ready to go. And we did some really great stuff, saved lives, saved legs, but didn't do that much of it, you know, even though...
And they did have all the equipment you'd ever need as far as medical equipment.
Everything you'd need.
That's wonderful.
Everything you'd need. And then you did. But, you know, you talk about our soldiers now. I mean, we've always had good soldiers, but now they are unbelievable. I had one soldier who got shot in the knee, blew his knee all to smithereens, you know. And so I took him to the operating room, cleaned him up, and put an external fixator, you know, put pins above, pins below, and outrigged it and stabilized it so he could be transferred back to Germany. And after he woke up, I said, well, son, you know, we'll have you in Germany tomorrow. And he goes, oh, no, sir. He says, you can take care of me. I know you can. I can be of service here. I can answer the phone.
He didn't want to go back.
These guys don't want to go back. I mean, they are so motivated. I mean, if they're not out on patrol, they're cleaning their weapons, or they're in the weight room, or, I mean, these guys are serious.
Why do you think that it's different now?
Well, this volunteer army, there's something to it. These guys want to fight.
Much better than the draft, I guess.
Oh, light years better. Now, there are good parts about the draft. I think that everybody ought to serve their country, yes. But if you really want to fight, you want people who are interested in fighting.
Right.
And these guys are interested in fighting. And so, the idea that you hear on the media, the morale and stuff, our morale is unbelievable. These guys are soldiers. They're serious. They're professional. And there's no better way to test your mettle than in a real war. Mm-hmm. And these guys have got it, and they're happy to do it.
Now, is there a chance you'll have to go again somewhere?
Well, you know, that's always a possibility. However, I told the powers that be, you know, I'm 62 years old now. I don't need to be, you know, schlepping around the rest of the world. So, I don't really need to be deployed again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know how much longer I got in the military, but, you know, I've got, I guess, like 44 years in now. So
really? So
we'll see.
You'd do it all over again.
Oh, in a minute. In a minute.
Do you have any memories that stand out above all the rest of while you were deployed? Or?
Well, you know, it was all such a treat. You know, just my soldiers just being such good people and hard workers and to be so successful that almost everything we did, we were the stars in the theater. You know, it was like every time I'd meet with the general, it's like, I can't believe you guys did that again. You know, that was great, you know. When we had during the war, you have convoys, and then you have convoy commanders, and I got, normally, I had 50 or so vehicles, but the general felt that I had, that my unit was so good that we could command 130 vehicles. So they added units to us for us to take care of them on this convoy during war. You might think, well, that's a pain in the neck. That just makes you proud that they thought we were that good.
I would think so. And I guess all the people with you felt just as proud as you did.
At the time, that's another interesting thing about a military experience is that when you're doing it, it often makes your teeth hurt. And then when you finish, it's like, whoa, we did some neat stuff.
Yeah.
And that was really fun. That's the way it works.
Yeah, I could imagine that would be true. What impact did that have, if any, on your practice and your family life being gone that long?
Oh, that's a whole, there's so many stories associated with this. And one of them was, here I am, I'm a solo practitioner, very busy, do a ton of surgery, and now I've got all of these people who need to be followed during their post-operative convalescence, and I'm going to be gone. It's like, whoa. Now, it just so happens that I'm a faculty member at the University of Kentucky, and I teach there one day a week and been doing it, for 30 years now. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the chairman of the Department of Orthopedics was just stepping down from his administrative role. Didn't really want to retire yet, but he just didn't want to be the chief anymore. And so he calls me and says, hey, Dobbs, I hear you're going to the desert. Another one of those conversations. I says, oh, yeah, boss. I says, boy, I don't know what to do. I got big trouble with my practice. He says, I'll tell you what. He says, I've never been out in the private world. I've only been in academia. He says, how about I come and babysit your patients while you're gone? And I go, would you do that for me? He says, oh, he says, nope. He says, that's my one part for the war. I said, oh, that'd be great. Do I need to pay you and all stuff? He says, oh, don't worry about any of that. He says, my wife has never let me have a sports car. He says, if you just let me use that car, that's all you have to do. And so he came and did that for nothing. And then a thing that went on with this is we'd always had discussions about, the general orthopedist and the super specialist and all this stuff, and what's the future of orthopedics. And I was always a believer that, a guy, if he reads a lot, studies hard, and is good, can do everything and do it well. And he wasn't so sure of that. He had all these ultra specialists with him at the university. And then I remember one night sitting in the desert, he'd written me a letter and says, Dobner, you may be right. He said, you do awfully good work, and I can't believe that you do, and you get such good results, and your patients are so loyal to you. He says, there are people who need surgery. I tell them, well, we'll get you to a place, because he wasn't going to do any surgery. Mm-hmm. I'll get you to where you need to be. They said, no, we'll wait for Dobner to come home. He says, I've never seen people that dedicated to another doc. He says, I thought those days were gone. So to get that validation that someone of his caliber, I mean, this guy's world renowned, and he gets to look over all my life's work, unfiltered, and probably the people coming back weren't the ones that have done the very best. But for him to tell me that, man, you do good work. You couldn't pay millions of dollars for a validation like that. Mm-hmm. And that's another spinoff of the military experience. And it's like, oh, thankfully that was...
That almost made it all worth it, didn't it?
Oh, you're far away. Well, that was added. That was icing on the cake. Everything was worth it. But that was... That may be my... for someone to look over the stuff, your life's work, and say, you're good. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do, you can't pay for that.
Well, really, that was great.
That's what it really was.
What about I hear a lot of veterans who come back and suffer from PTSD. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, PTSD is a toughie. You know, there are some people who can stand stress and other people can't stand stress. And that's just the way it is. Did we have stress? Yes, we all had stress. And, you know, you could kind of pick out the people who weren't handling stress great before. And sure enough, when they came back, they had more problems too. You know, I'm kind of one of those hard heads, you know, that by God, you just got to make it work, you know, and everybody gets dealt a different hand. You know, some people are smarter, some people are bigger, some people are stronger, some people work harder, and you just got to get after it, you know, and blaming other things and stuff like that. Yeah, I don't, you know, I think you're responsible for yourself. You're responsible for your own success. Mm-hmm. Are there people who have it? Yes, there are. What can we do about it? I don't know.
So do you think it happens as often now that we have a volunteer army instead of draft?
Well, I don't think it happens near as often. But it still happens. And, you know, it's a funny thing, you know, fear and that kind of thing. I understand that now. You know, I was, philosophy now that, you know, we could probably stop war if we just send 50-year-old guys to fight, because your courage is gone. Mm-hmm. You know, this last deployment, you know, I was never afraid in Desert Storm. I was never afraid of anything. I just didn't. But in this engagement, I got, you know, one night we got bombed, and boy, I was scared to death, absolutely scared to death. And it's like, I'm old enough to die now. I've done everything I need to do. You know, it's not a big deal if I, you know, kick the bucket. But I was still scared. Ooh, I was scared.
Well, how many years were between the Gulf War and the when you went the first?
Yeah, there was about 12, 14
okay.
years. Yeah.
So it was a real different experience the second time.
It was
time
different.
Then.
It was like, you know, like I say, I was an Indian, and the first time I was a chief. But equally as much fun. You know, and the characters were neat. A lot of neat people I got to meet. And again, learning about, you know, the Muslims and the Afghans and how... that was, you know, I learned a lot, you know, and the Afghanis, you know, they don't want to have an Islamic society, you know, they want something like we got, because, you know, they say the clerics in the country are power hungry. They want to run the church and the state. Mm-hmm. And the fellow I was with, he was a member of the Loya Jirga and, you know, the chief of orthopedics and a very respected person in the community. I mean, this guy was solid. And he says, you know, we can't speak out against the clerics, even in the Loya Jirga. He says, because, you know, they'll call you an infidel and a zealot will come by and cut your tongue out. And he says, that's why you Americans need to be here. He says, you keep that element down. He says, and we want a democracy. He says, look at the last election. He said, over 80% voted. He says, you've never had that in your country. Yeah. He said, and all these people had their purple fingers. He says, and they were easy targets. They were all threatened that they would be killed if they voted. They still voted, 80% of them. They want it, you know, and so I was, you know, but they don't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, they get elected dog catcher and they want to turn into a tyrant. That's all they've ever learned. That's all they've ever known.
They don't know how to be any different.
They don't know how to be any different. And that's why we tell them, no. You're a servant now. Now that you're elected, you're a servant. Now, we have some tyrants in our government, too, that we may need to rein in a little bit.
Well, how did that affect you, being there and seeing how they live and how they their government works?
It gives you such appreciation for what we have. I mean, you know, our poorest of the poor are just so much better off than the average person over there. Oh, we are so lucky, and everybody ought to go to a third world country. Now you go to Acapulco and just stay in the hotel. You're not going to tell anything, but you know, you really look out in the third world countries and see how fortunate we are. We are so fortunate.
What were their living conditions in the normal household there?
Oh, you know, there's some unbelievably austere, mud huts and stuff like that. And one of the amazing things, we were on this convoy out to take care of these nomads. They got nomads floating around there too, and driving down these little roads, and I saw this stuff that was kind of like stuck on the wall, and I, you know, what is that? And it was cow poop that they'd stick on the wall to dry, and then it'd come off as a cake, and then they'd pile those up, and that's what they'd burn in the wintertime.
Oh my!
And it's just like,
we are fortunate.
Whoa! they don't hardly have any wood to burn. They burnt all their wood.
Yeah.
And any kind of pole over there is concrete. They don't make wooden poles because they chop it down and burn it.
Right.
So it's,
oh. Yeah, that was a real that would be a real eye-opener too.
Oh, so many things I learned. And when the Lord finished building the earth, he had a whole bunch of rocks left and he put them all in Afghanistan. They are just,
let's see. Is there anything else you want to share that I haven't?
Sure, I could talk forever about these things. You know, it's just such a wonderful experience, and it gives you great pride, you know, to have served this wonderful country we have, and we've done some great things across the world, and we're doing great things across the world, and these people like us. I mean, that's the other thing is, boy, I didn't run into a single person who was at anywhere near negative about us. They were just so happy we were there. But that's, you don't hear that, you know, in the media, and you don't hear these things about, you know, how we need to be there. And then, you know, and even, you know, we've got people traipsing around the world apologizing for our behavior. We have nothing to apologize mm-hmm. for.
That's interesting to hear that they do want us there. And
you
that
betcha they
like
want
us
there.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, you know, I didn't see a single banner, you know, Yankee go home. Not a chance.
No. Even and the people were really friendly to you.
Very, very much friendly. Yeah. But their infrastructure is so terrible. Like their hospital. You know, I got when I was at the university there. You know, I got to work with this guy, and in the operating. In the operating room, you know, there's, you know, it's very austere. The equipment, I mean, we were going to do, he asked me to help him do some muscle transfers for a nerve injury. It's a pretty big operation, and they bring out this pan of instruments, probably 24 instruments in this pan. You know, we pop pimples with more than 25 instruments. You know, when I do a hip replacement, I probably have 1,000 instruments, mm-hmm. you know, ready to go. They don't, you know, it's just like, wow. And they had two beds for each room, and their anesthesia consisted of ketamine, which is it's a dissociative agent. We don't use it here much because it can give you bad dreams. There's some bright spots about it because you really don't need to breathe for them, that they keep breathing and stuff. It just kind of scrambles your brain so that you can't, either you can't feel it or you can't remember it, one or the other. But in any event, that's all they used. And do major operations with these things. Mm-hmm. And there are two beds for each room. And so I was getting ready to, and he says, well, how would you do this? And I showed him, I mapped out the incisions I'd make, and we make these big incisions to get to see everything. And he says, oh, we can't do that. He says, you notice the flies flying around here. If we make those big wounds like that, they all get infected. So you have to do these through little holes. And I basically said, you know, I've never done it through small holes. He says, well, here's how we do it. And he showed me. It was masterful. Masterful. And then while we were doing this, they wheeled another patient in for the chief of surgery. It's this old Afghani who, he's in his 70s, but, you know, he was trained in Germany and almost like never left the hospital. And could do anything, could do orthopedics, could do anything. He was just so good, and everybody looked up to him. And they brought this woman in with a goiter, and her neck, she looked like she had a tire around her neck. It was such a big goiter. Oh, I mean, and these neck things are bloody. I mean, whoa. You know, I'm going, oh, man, this is going to be a bloodbath. And by gum, you know, it was 20, 25 minutes, he was done, next to no bleeding. It was like, this guy's good.
Really?
He's really good. But their infrastructure is so terrible. You know, in the chief of orthopedics there, you know, he at one, one point he was saying, you know, you notice our infrastructure is so terrible. He says, if you, I don't care how much money you put in here, it's not going to improve. He said, the graft, the corruption, all the rest of this stuff, he says, the government just can't do it. Mm-hmm. He says, I've got 15 of the best surgeons in Jalalabad who we have decided we're going to build a private hospital. He says, because there are people in around here who've got some money. They used to, all the Middle East used to go to Afghanistan prior to when the Russians were there. Mm-hmm. The Russians, he said, just devastated their medical system. He says, because Russians don't care about medicine. He said, they'd send people down like you come, you know. He says, you know, supposedly they're some of their most learned people. He says, they were idiots. He said, we ran them out. They didn't know anything. He says, and that's what Russia is all about. And so our government then just took the lead from that you don't have to worry about medicine. You know, just, you know, you can pass out Band-Aids, that's all you need. And he says, that's got us all disturbed. But he says, so we want to build this private hospital, but I need your help. And I'm going, oh, okay, yeah, he wants $15 million. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't have that. He says, now, we don't need any money, or, you know, we've got all the financings and stuff nailed down. He says, but the warlord wants 25% of the project. And he says, there's not that margin in it, and we've got to get him off our back. Could you help me? So, well, we were staying in was called the PRT, Provincial Reconstruction Team, which is it's a small little compound, and it's got some special forces in it, and some rangers and public affairs people, and then they call them OGAs, other governmental agents, which was the CIA, code word for CIA. And so I went back to the commander, and I told him the story, and he says, well, you need to talk to Jones over here. You know, he's the OGA who runs the warlord. And so I went and talked to him, and he said, oh, man, this guy. He said, this warlord is a crumb. He says, we're about ready to lock him up. You know, he gets in the way of everything that's going to be any good for these people. And so he says, I'll take care of that. So I'm hoping, you know, I haven't been able to communicate with them because they don't have, you know, mail over there. And so I hope they got their project. But he understood entrepreneurial spirit. He knew what it would mean, that if he did it himself and don't depend on the government, they could get it done and they could have a good facility. I was so proud of him.
But you can't keep in contact with him.
No, I couldn't. No, you just didn't. Yeah. I wish I knew how he was doing. And, you know, the problem is I would never go over there unless it's in the military.
Really?
The security. You know, the military can military will protect you.
Right.
They protect their own. But to go over there as a volunteer or something, not on a bet.
No. Mm-mm. Doesn't sound like it would be the best thing. The
Taliban are bad people. They are just horrible people. You know, if you read the book, you know, Kite Runner, that explains those people, and they're terrible.
I'll have to read that.
Terrible. Yeah. Kite Runner, yeah. And then he's written another one, a sequel to it, and I don't know the name of that. I haven't run that one yet. It's Khalid Hosseini is the author. But Kite Runner is there's a movie out about Kite Runner, too, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a couple of years old now. It's not a fun book to read. I mean, it is. It's sad.
Yeah.
But it explains the Afghani lifestyle.
I'll get that and read it. Let's see. Is there anything else you want to share that you've not touched
I've
on?
I've talked about everything. I can talk forever. I mean, it's just...
I really appreciate you coming in and doing this, and this will be such a help to them. Let me turn this off now.